Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, June 26, 2011, and this is show number 318. Well, Steve and I have been hard at work this weekend bringing some much-needed enhancements to the NoSilicast. All right, they're not, like, that huge, but they seem to be essential ingredients that we were missing. First of all, there's a new Twitter feed for you to follow. We need you to follow NoSilicast. A lot of people thought it existed already and would tweet to it, and every once in a while I'd pick up the message if I was doing a search or something like that. So we thought it was time to actually create the NoSilicast Twitter account. Now, our idea is that I can move to doing more tweeting specifically about the show on at NoSilicast. Things like, you know, when I'm planning to review for the week, asking for dumb questions, that sort of thing. Then all the stuff like what kind of cheese sandwich I had and other nonsense can live over on the at Podfeet Twitter handle. Makes me look more professional, don't you think? Or possibly more confusing for all of you. Who can tell? The other thing we did was create an official NoSilicast fan page over on Facebook. You may remember a failed attempt at that a while back when Facebook had group pages. Turns out they've abandoned that now in favor of fan pages. We're still working on it and figuring out where we can add value to you, but it's coming along nicely, I think. If you go to facebook.com/nosilicast.podcast, you can like the page. I think what happens when you like a page is then updates to that page show up in your newsfeed. I'm always a little bit muddled on exactly what Facebook is doing, to be honest. I sure hope that's what happens when you do that. I posted a question on the wall over there asking what other things you'd like to get from a fan page beyond what you already get from the podcast, the blog, and the tweets, because I'm looking for more work to do. I know I'll post pictures and videos from events there, so that'll be cool, and it'll give you another place you can chatter with each other outside of the live show and tweeting, so that could be cool too. If you can think of more ideas, let me know. Heck, write it on the wall over on our Facebook page. Well, I love the reaction of the live chat room. There are some people who don't necessarily really like Facebook, evidently. Let's see, Everyday Mac Support says, Facebook makes me cringe. Big in Virginia says, Facebook makes me feel violated. Carell says, my mom's on Facebook. That was the last nail in the coffin for me. Jenna Duffy says, Facebook is the spawn of the devil. Really, you guys, tell me what you really think about Facebook. Oh, well, I will do Facebook for the people who like Facebook, but as always, you can remember that you don't have to do Facebook. Heck, there's people who think Twitter's weird, so, you know, there's something for everybody here. Well, a great number of the NoSilla castaways sent me excited emails and tweets when Google announced that they had instituted pivot tables in Google Spreadsheets. They were not excited for themselves, of course, but for me. They know my love of pivot tables, so they knew I'd be tickled pink about it. They were right, of course. Let's start with a problem to be solved, shall we? I deliver you the podcast using a service called Libsyn. They do a good job of keeping track of all the downloads by show and by time. They do a crappy job of graphing it, though. They graph every day, and I want to see it aggregated by month instead. I used Excel to create a much nicer graph, and I decided to test out Google Spreadsheets for the same thing. I'll explain how pivot tables come into the plot to solve the problem as we go along. This particular experiment also allowed me to test out some other functionality of Google Docs, too. In Libsyn, I downloaded a comma-separated value file, that's also known as a CSV file, of my last year's download numbers. I opened it in Excel. When the stats came in, I had two columns, date and download. The date format was month, day, and two-digit year. I needed to transform this to the year and month in that order so it would be easily sortable. Excel has a formula called simply year. Let's say in cell A2 you have the date as Libsyn gave it to me, 9/1/06. Excel knows this is not just a text element, knows this is a date with a month, day, and year. That intelligence is actually in the value. In order to figure out how many downloads are in the month of September 2006, we need to change cell 9106 from cell A2 into the formula 2006/9. In a cell to the right, I can type in equals year parentheses A2. Excel will enter the number 2006. The default format for the cell actually changes it from 06 to 2006 because it knows I'm asking for a year. In the next column over, I did the same thing, only using the month formula. So it said equals month parentheses A2, and returns the number 9. So now instead of 9/1/06, I have a cell C2 that says 2006 and D2 says 09, or 9 actually. Now I need a new column to concatenate these values together so that it says 2006/9. Wow, this sounded more exciting when I was writing it than it does right now, but stick with me. This is a great formula, one of my favorites. I simply write concatenate, parentheses, C2, D2, but I need to put a couple things in between. So it's C2, comma, quote, slash, unquote, comma, D2. So that's going to give us C2 and D2 separated by a slash. Now, all I have to do is fill down on all these formulas, so I'll get all of the values for all of my downloads with the year month attached to it. You still with me? Okay, it's going to get more exciting, I promise. So now I have maybe 25 values for downloads that are all for September 2006. I need those all added together so that I get one number for 2006. Now, I could do subtotals on that column by change in date, but that turns into a big fat mess, and it's hard to pull those values out of the table to do a graph. Enter pivot tables to the rescue. With a simple pivot table, I can say, show me the unique dates in the left column with the sum of values for that date in the right column. Here's how you do it. First, make sure every single column in the table you're working with has a title. Pivot tables barf immediately if you're missing a title. Click anywhere in this table we've made and start your pivot table. So I was going to explain all the different places in all the different versions of Excel, whether you're on Mac or Windows or 2004 or 2008 or 2003 on Windows or 2007 or 2010, that you would go to look for this. But actually, let's just say this. It's either under Insert or it's under Data, depending on which version you're running. So it's really confusing because Microsoft moved it around. But depending on which version you're using, just choose Insert or Data until you find pivot tables. Anyway, all you do is drag the name of your column for the final date to the row labels area and the downloads number to the values field and make sure it says sum on it. With that very quick pivot table, you now have all of your months in one column and the sum of downloads in the next column. From there, you can plot your little heart away. Okay, works perfectly on Excel. Took me, maybe 10 minutes to do the whole thing. Now it's time to test this all again over on Google Docs. I was not in the least bit expecting this to work at all because my previous experiments had not gone well with Google Docs. Starting from the beginning in Google, I could import the CSV or just copy and paste the values that I already had in Excel since I was kind of lazy. I tried out the year and month functions in Google and they worked exactly as they did in Excel. I did the concatenate function and it too made one value for the year slash month exactly as I hoped it would. By the way, I should mention, this is, of course, typed up in the show notes so you can follow through and test it out and try it on your own so you don't have to remember exactly how to spell concatenate, for example. Next up, it was time to find out where pivot tables were in Google, and luckily they were under data where God invented them to be. The tool is slightly different, but very intuitive to me. Google showed me rows, columns, values, and filter. Next to each one, it said add field. So I clicked on the add field for rows and selected year slash month. For values, I chose add field and picked downloads. Boom, there's my pivot table. I could easily change it from sum if I wanted to, but of course in this case, that is what I wanted to show. I would call that a win for Google, except for one problem. The pivot table doesn't show any headings. My first month value is plopped right in A1 with no heading above it. Without that heading, I can't graph it. If you click in the pivot table, the little wizard pops up from the side telling you what your columns and rows are, but that's really not that much help. I had to copy the cells and then do a paste special somewhere else in the sheet. Paste special allows me to just copy the values without the formulas, you know, like concatenate and all that junk. This wasn't a huge deal because, to be honest, I almost always copy data from pivot tables to static data before I plot. Invariably, there's something I don't like about the data, like it's not ordered correctly or formatted correctly. I'm kind of a control freak that way, I guess. But it did turn out to be a big deal because I could not find paste special. Only after sitting back and relaxing for a minute did I realize that instead of calling it paste special and then having a submenu where you chose paste values or paste formatting, they actually just have a paste values and paste formatting option right in the old edit menu. It's actually pretty handy, saved me a step. Before I decided to just copy and paste the values, I tried to move the data in the pivot table down a row, you know, so I could add a row for the heading. I positively could not figure out how to do that. I could add an entire row above the pivot table, but I had other things to the right that I didn't want moved down. I tried to shift select all of the cells and just move them down one row, but that proved hard to do. That little move hand was a tricky little devil to find and use. When I made the chart, it was very easy to create, but again, hard to move. I had to figure out where the hand went. It goes at the top on the chart, but it was at the bottom when you were selecting cells. Very confusing. Then I selected, then I figured out that with the chart selected, a disclosure triangle showed up, allowing me to edit the chart, including changing the scale of the graph, adding titles, and all that. I also never found a way to modify the angle and format of the axis values. It's got to be in there somewhere, but the chart came out with the dates at a 45-degree angle, and I wanted them vertically done, but I never cracked the code to do that. I couldn't change the font size or format the axis either. All in all, it worked well, with some of the easier, more trivial bits being really hard to do. The pivot tables, which were the hard part, worked exactly as they should work. I have to begrudgingly admit that Google Spreadsheets is actually becoming pretty darn useful these days, and I might at some point in the future suggest it as a viable alternative to Excel. Not for me, of course, but maybe someday for somebody else. Well, it's time for Dumb Question Corner, but for some reason, GarageBand 9 has decided that I can't drop in the Dumb Question Corner theme music today. Not quite sure why, but we just tried about 7 times, quit GarageBand a couple of times, but someone in the chat room, I forget who it was, assured me that OS X, Wade Gutman assured me that OS X never has problems, so I just clearly am mistaken. In any case, let's get started with our dumb question. William from upstate New York wrote in with our first dumb question. Here's what he said. I've had Macs for about 4 years now, and I'm a slider due to my need to use Windows at work. I love the Mac, but I have one dumb question. Why does Apple refer to wireless local networks as airport while the rest of the known universe calls it Wi-Fi? Shouldn't I be running to my local Apple store to buy a Wi-Fi Extreme? Hey, that sounds kind of cool. My apologies if you've discussed this before. I try to catch all of your shows, but invariably some of them slip through. I'm sure there's some colorful Steve story behind the name Airport. Love the show. Well, William, thank you very much for the kind words. That's what really keeps me going on this. And please, 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 everybody stop feeling guilty when they've missed a show or they're behind by a show or behind by 10 shows. This should only be joy. So listen when you can. Don't listen when you can't. Don't feel bad. Pick it back up. Take a break. It's all good. I don't want there ever to be guilt about this. That just sucks the fun out of it. So don't worry about that at all. Anyway, it's funny you should mention this question right now because it looks like Apple may actually be backing away from that name. Maybe you already knew that. Evidently, it causes some confusion with new users to the platform. They're hunting around looking for Wi-Fi, and it's actually called Airport. I started thinking about this, and it occurred to me that it's not the first time Apple has done something like this. There's a spec called IEEE 1394. Apple calls it FireWire, while Sony calls it iLink. There's another spec called IEEE 802.11. Apple calls it Airport, others call it Wi-Fi, which stands, by the way, for wireless fidelity. Apple is usually groundbreaking in these technologies, and they believe/hope that people will follow their lead so they give things cool names. They just came out with the Thunderbolt port, developed by Intel. I'm wondering how much they had to do with the name on that one, and whether others will choose a different name. It's going to be interesting to see if Apple drops the Airport name, won't it? In other words, I'm telling you, I don't think there's any great, grand, exciting explanation behind this one, but it is kind of interesting, and it never occurred to me since I live mostly, by preference, in the Macintosh world. My friend Lori wrote in with a great testimonial for a Mac repair service that will be great for us to keep in mind if we ever run into the same problem she did. The Sarah in the story she tells about is her daughter, and I want to tell you her story, but I want you to know that she's actually very, very picky. So take her praise here with understanding that she doesn't say nice things about people and services unless she really, really believes in them. Here's her letter to me. Hi, Allison. I don't know if you remember, but Sarah's laptop screen was damaged after she put it in her checked bag on the way to school at New Year's. She discussed getting it repaired, but the cost seemed to be so great that she decided to live with it because it wasn't all that bad, or at least it could be worked around. Anyway, in the spring, she and I agreed that as a graduation present, we would get her a new MacBook Air, and I would use the damaged laptop when I traveled. Last week, while I was visiting her for graduation and using my laptop, the damage had migrated and was so bad I decided to research getting a new screen. I found two options. First, buying a new screen for about $90 and installing it myself. But everyone said it was fairly difficult unless you were really skilled. Or sending it to rotten-apples.net to have it replaced by them for $200 including shipping. So I chose the latter, and in only 6 days turnaround, I have a new laptop. Woohoo! It's great! I just thought you might want to tell your people about this company. They were great and did exactly what they said they would for the exact price they quoted. Again, the URL is rotten-apples.net. Well, thanks, Lori, for a great testimonial. We're always asking each other for recommendations on companies that could give good service, and I'm certainly going to keep this one in mind. It's nice to hear somebody did what they said they were going to do, did it for a great price, and you're really, really happy with them. This weekend, when Steve and I were working on setting up the new NoSilicast fan page on Facebook and the new Twitter account for NoSilicast, I realized that every single week on Sunday afternoons, I type into a tweet, "Live show at 5 p.m. Pacific time tonight. Join the live chat at http://podfeed.com/live. Now, why do I take the time to type that entire thing in every week? Why don't I just launch Text Expander and type it in once and assign it a tiny little snippet that I can remember and just use that every week? Jeez, I can't believe I didn't think of that one. Well, finally today, I did just that. Now, instead of typing 84 characters, I type L-I-V-E with a semicolon, and boom, it comes right out, all 84 characters. So I'm saving 79, oh, I said 80 characters, but close enough. I'm saving 80 characters a week times 52 weeks a year. That's 4,160 characters a year. At, let's say, 45 words per minute, I'm saving over an hour and a half. Not to mention thinking up how to say it each year from just that one snippet. I mean, think about it. That's just one snippet saving me an hour and a half a year. If you can afford to waste time and you really enjoy repetitive stress injuries, then whatever you do, don't head on over to smilesoftware.com and buy Text Expander. Or think about what your time is worth. Buy yourself a little gift. Be sure to tell them you decided to buy because you heard it on the NoSilicast. A while ago, good friend of the show, George from Tulsa, brought in a nifty little utility to my attention. I'm finally ready to tell you all about it. But we must start with a problem to be solved, of course. My love of Windows does not run deep, but there's just a few little things I prefer over OS X. One of them is the ability to resize the window from any side, not just the bottom right-hand corner. Another nice feature in Windows 7 is how you can drag a window to the top of the screen and it automatically resizes to be full screen. You can also drag to the far left or right, have it fill exactly half the screen, so you can position two windows side by side. It's really, really useful. Enter Flexiglass from Nulana. It's a Mac utility that gives you some of these same features and adds some new ones of its own. Flexiglass is available two ways. You can get it at the Mac App Store, or they have a reseller link that you can buy it through. I started with a free trial over at nulana.com/flexiglass, and within minutes, I knew I had to have it. It's only 10 bucks, and I thought, I might want to sneak it onto Steve's Macs too, so I bought it in the Mac App Store since they let you put it on all of your authorized Macs, or maybe up to 5, I'm not sure. But that's big enough for us. Anyway, that's when I discovered a rather serious flaw in the Mac App Store process. Since it takes a while to get a new version approved, the one I got from the Mac App Store was not the latest one that I downloaded on the free trial. And in fact, it seemed to have some bugs that it didn't let me use it properly when I first got it. The good news is that when I wrote to the folks at Nulana, Anna Sanikova was really, really helpful. She was sending me different versions, and she had me run some bug report things for her. And in the end, she told me, just ignore their nagware until the new version got in the App Store and keep using that trial version. Turned out it was only a week or two later that it came into the App Store with the new version, and the new version worked great. To me, it really matters how you're treated. I mean, even if there's problems, if somebody stays with you and gives you some help, that's the only way to go. With that Apple problem aside, let's get to know how this lovely application works. Assuming you have a laptop for the time being, or a Mac with a magic trackpad, to resize a window, you hold down the Option key, drag three fingers around on the trackpad. It's really lovely to do this. I really enjoy it. And for some reason, it almost instantly stuck in my muscle memory. That's the case of them picking a good keystroke combination thing, I think. I love resizing windows now. If you want to move a window around without dragging all the way up to the top of a window, or maybe you can't even reach the top of the window because somehow it got above the top, if you use the option and two fingers, it allows you to drag a window around without just from any spot on the window. Again, that option finger gesture seemed very natural immediately to me. If you like, in the preferences, you can set it up so that when you're moving or resizing a window with the gestures, you see a colored border of your choice. I'm not sure it's necessary, but it's a nice touch. If while dragging a window, either the traditional way or with the option two-finger gesture, you drag to the top of the screen, an animation pops up showing you a gray window filling the screen. If you let go, your window pops to full screen. Drag down from the top, and it pops back to its original size. Same thing with dragging to the left or right of the screen. It'll pop to the right or left, filling exactly half of the screen, just like it does in Windows 7. I think for sliders, this is just going to make you so happy. I often like this feature on Windows when I'm trying to move content from one thing to another, or I'm trying to figure out what's different between two versions of something, that sort of thing. On Windows and using Flexiglass on the Mac, this half screen and full thing screen thing causes goofy behavior with a dual monitor setup. On Windows, I have my second monitor directly above my laptop, and every once in a while, a window will like stretch to be the entire height of both monitors, which might be good if I wanted that, but I rarely do. On the Mac, Flexiglass seems to think I'm trying to go half screen when I'm actually dragging between monitors. The gray animation warns me, though, that if I let go right then, that's what's going to happen, so all I do is keep moving and it doesn't bork anything up and doesn't do anything wrong. Luckily, I do get that warning. You can also use a keystroke to pop the window to the right, left, half, or even half top and bottom of the screen. I just learned this one, so we'll see if it sticks in the memory as well as the others. But to do this, you use all three modifier keys, Control, Option, and Command, and use one arrow key, up, down, right, or left. I think I do that infrequently enough that I'll just stick with the dragging and dropping, but if you do it a lot, I bet you'd really like that. I should mention that all of these gesture key modifiers can be set to anything you like. You don't have to use the ones they suggest. Now, according to the video on the new Lana site, you can use the green button on any window to go full screen and back. It works like a champ. Why didn't Apple just build it that way correctly in the first place? Why do some applications do it and some don't? I forgot how much that bugged me until Flexiglass fixed it. Now, I wasn't thrilled with how Flexiglass works when you have a mouse and trackpad enabled. The mouse seemed to override the trackpad for me, so if I tried to use three-fingered option gesture, for example, instead of resizing a window, and if I was doing this on a browser, the browser would go back or forward, which I think is either built into OS X or maybe it's part of Chrome, the browser I've been using lately. I'm not sure, but I basically couldn't use my gestures, and that drove me crazy. Then I realized that you can have Flexiglass selected to auto-detect a mouse when it's attached, which I disabled now so I could get my precious gestures back. You might prefer the mouse gestures, but I don't. So it's nice Flexiglass lets us choose which one makes us both happy. The video over on Nulana.com showed one feature that never worked for me. There's a feature you can turn on they call Real Close, which when enabled is supposed to quit a program if you right-click the red button on a window. In the applications I tried, it just closed the window like it normally does. This one isn't a big deal to me, but it might be a big deal to a switcher or a slider who's driven crazy by all those open applications they leave when they could have sworn they closed them. Overall, I'm thrilled with Flexiglass, and I encourage you to check out their video. I actually embedded it on the podfeet.com site. Then you can go over to nulana.com/flexiglass and give their free 15-day trial a spin to see if it's for you. I hope you enjoy that tool. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for chit-chat across the pond with Bart Bouchatz. How are you doing today, Bart?
I'm not too bad. We had a work barbecue last night. There was lots of alcohol involved. I'm a little sore-headed today, but I'll live.
Oh, dear. Well, I'm glad it's in the evening for you by now. So you've recovered. Well, we've got some good topics in Security Light here. I've definitely been interested in exactly what you're talking about here. So why don't we jump right in?
Okie dokie. The first one is Firefox have decided in their infinite wisdom that 3 months is time enough for Firefox 4 to exist. and they're now force upgrading everyone to Firefox 5.
Yeah, so, like, I didn't see anything anywhere about that. I was just, like, doodling along on my Windows PC, and it says, Firefox 5 is here. Do you want it? I didn't hear it on Twitter. I didn't hear it on Tech News Today. I didn't hear it on Twitter. I didn't hear it anywhere. It's just like, boom, it was there.
Well, it's been around some of the tech sites because people are very angry about it.
Why's that?
Okay, so if you have Firefox plugins installed, one of the things inside every plugin is a little header that says, you know, what versions of Firefox this plugin is compatible with. Mm-hmm. And the general rule of thumb is that, you know, nothing major is going to change in the Firefox APIs within major versions. So what you would usually find in that header is stuff like 4. Star.
Okay.
So which means anything. 4. Anything, and I'm going to register myself as being a working plugin. Mm-hmm. What's, you know, when plugin developers redo everything is when we go to major versions. So all the plugins out there would have been 4. Star. What Firefox did was release Firefox 5 and not patch Firefox 4 against known vulnerabilities. So everyone has to update to 5 to be secure, but almost no plugins have yet been updated, or there are many that have not.
So they didn't have the developers involved telling them that 5 was coming?
It's only been 3 months since 4 came out. So they've said that they're going to go to 6 within this year. Basically, they're just trying to chase IE for numbers. This is utterly vain and stupid.
So this could have been 4.1.
It should have been 4.1. Hmm. Or 4.01 even. Or 4.5. Or, I mean, you know, we've had 3.0 and 3.5 and then 3.6. What they've done here is they've forced people to choose between either giving up on plugins they need or knowingly being insecure. What sort of a decision is that to force on your users?
Not to mention, one of the greatest things about Firefox is the extensibility, right? I mean,
that's the whole point of it, yeah.
Right. I mean, it's not for its speed, that's for sure.
Well, in Firefox 4, that's a little better. A lot of the memory leaks that we were promised were plugged in 2 and then were promised again were plugged in 3, I think have actually been plugged in 4.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't get the runaway processes like I used to, but it was not fast enough. I switched to Chrome a few weeks ago. You know, I'll be back.
Yeah, well, I use both Chrome and Firefox all the time. I have both browsers running, and anything I use plugins with, I do in Firefox. Anything I don't, I do in Chrome. Mm-hmm. So I always have both running, and I switch over and back between them constantly. But at work, I've moved to Firefox 4, and I've now moved up to Firefox 5, and I've lost one plugin that I'm cranky about, but I'm hoping it'll come back. At home, I'm still on Firefox 3.6, and now I'm absolutely definitely not going to move until they absolutely force me to. Because Firefox 3.6 got patched. 3.6.18 was released, which fixes the same vulnerabilities that Firefox 4 is never going to be patched against.
Really?
Yeah, so those of us who stayed on 3.6 are safe. Everyone who moved to 4 has just basically been given the middle finger and told you can either knowingly be insecure or you can lose your functionality, your choice. Which is a complete Hobson's choice. Utterly pointless. It's pure vanity. We want to get to Firefox 6 by the end of the year. I've never been as angry at Firefox and as likely to tell people, if you haven't tried Chrome, now's the time, because these people do not deserve your respect anymore.
Yeah, why? Have they made any statements? I mean, has our chief lizard wrangler done anything about it, written anything?
No, I've not seen any valid reason for this version number race. I haven't seen any. I don't think it's possible to have a valid reason for this kind of stupid exercise. There is no valid reason for changing major version numbers like this, and it's just vanity. We're only on Firefox 4, and Chrome is on 12, and IE's on 9. God, we look terrible, don't we? It's vanity. It's stupid, stupid, stupid carry-on.
Yeah, this doesn't make any sense.
You know, it's really, really annoyed me to the point where I will not recommend people go to Firefox. If you need the plugins, fair enough, but there's a big plugin architecture for Chrome now. Even Safari has plugins.
Safari's not Firefox, that bad anymore.
Yeah, I'd still take Chrome over Safari any day, to be honest.
Yeah.
Even if, ironically, Chrome is taking the innards of Safari and making it better.
Right,
but I guess
right.
That's the point of open source.
Sure, sure.
You know, Apple have open source WebKit, and Chrome are doing a better job of using Apple's code than Apple are doing of using Apple's code.
You know, another thing to think about is the is large corporations with, you know, they don't flip on a dime from something like Firefox 4 to Firefox 5. They can't.
Firefox has never been particularly corporate friendly, and this certainly ain't helping them there.
Yeah.
So, all in all, I've been my confidence in Firefox has been eroding over the last couple of years. And it's just been hit by a tsunami, you know, massive erosion with this one, to the point where I'm looking at getting away from Firefox. I'm looking at my other alternatives, and basically they're driving me into the arms of Google, which I don't feel particularly good about. But at the same time, this is not acceptable. This is just 3 months of support for a major version, and you're not even patching it for people? Come on.
Yeah. So I guess the only good thing is that we have choice, right?
Stay on Firefox 3.6. Yeah. Well, so the choice is staying with your memory leaks.
No. But, I mean, we have choice of Firefox, right, or Chrome or Safari. We've got Opera. You know, there's all kinds of choices out there, and thank goodness for that.
Yeah, I'm going to be spending a lot of time in the plugin library for Chrome trying to find replacements for all of the things I can't live without. If anyone feels like tweeting some suggestions, I really need something like tree-style tabs.
Oh, yeah, I like tree-style tabs. Those are fun.
Can't do without that grouping of tabs anymore. And the concept of having tabs across the top of my screen without them being collapsible is just insanity to me. I don't know how I ever got by without tree-style tabs.
I guess another thing that this brings up is the value of something like Xmarks. I'm a big fan of Xmarks from the same people they got bought by the guys that make LastPass. And it's basically Xmarks allows you to have your bookmarks synced across all different kinds of browsers. So as I promiscuously jump from Firefox to Chrome to Safari and back, I have all my bookmarks wherever I am. They're all arranged in the same order. They look the same. So it's real easy to just hop around. So as different companies do idiotic things.
Yeah, exactly. You can hop freely.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's go uphill. How's Dropbox this week, Bart?
This is sort of a good news, bad news story. On the one hand, the flow in question is bad news. So for a short period, and it was just, I'll get the exact numbers, because they were really good at disclosure. They were an inverse of Sony in how they handled this breach. So, and it wasn't as severe a breach as Sony's breach anyway. But
it's nice that Sony's there to set the bar things at the bottom, right? So you can step over it pretty easily.
So on the 19th of June at 1:54 p.m. Pacific time, Dropbox updated their code on their servers, and that change in code introduced a vulnerability where passwords were not being properly checked, and you could log into any Dropbox account with any password, which is pretty severe.
Yeah.
So that was at 1:54 p.m. Then at 5:41 p.m., Dropbox became aware of the problem, and at 5:46 p.m., that's 5 minutes later, the problem was fixed.
Wow.
So all
it's amazing
in all,
somebody noticed it in that short of a window.
Yes. So on the one hand, the response time of 5 minutes is very good. The openness and the level of detail they've gave us on the Dropbox blog is very good. However, a serious bug like this should never have gotten into production. There's something called regression testing, which is when you make a change to code, you should run it against all of your previous tests to make sure that you haven't introduced old bugs again, or reduced functionality by adding new functionality. It's called regression testing. And
you do things on a test server before you do it on your production server, that sort of thing.
It should be a test server, and it should have automated testing. So you put it on the test server, and you run your test suite against it, and your test suite should check against all the problems you ever had in the past, and any new problems you can think of, and any potential problems you can think of, anything you can think of. You should always add it to your test suite, and then automatically every bit of new code should be run through that test suite before it goes live. So this should never have gotten live. Now, I would imagine that they have now added a test. It's possible that the old test was, does the correct password let you in, which is a test of, does the login work? But they should have also had a test of, does a wrong password keep you out?
Oh, right.
In your test suite, yeah? Because that's testing if the right password gets you in is actually only half a test for a login script. So I would imagine, they've actually said in their blog that they're adding changes, they're scrutinizing their controls, and will be implementing additional safeguards, which I think is going to be a simple test added to their test suite that tests a wrong password and verifies that a wrong password gets an error rather than a success.
You know, having been a manager, I think frequently in these contexts about how do you know that the person that you're trusting to do something like handle security knows what they're doing? Because your entire framework is usually wrapped around that person. Or, you know, if you've got five people working this, you can tell which ones are the smart ones as a manager. Because as a manager, you don't really know how to do the job, right? That's why you're a manager, because you're not that bright. why I chose that path. But
some people get to management through the, you know, through the trenches, and some people get to management through university.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
so you have two kinds of managers.
I got there both ways, but I think I was a good manager because I knew what I didn't know, and I think that's a talent.
Right? Yeah, that's a very, very important talent,
because you can't know what everybody else below you knows. But how do you know whether you've got somebody? And this is a rhetorical question, of course. Mm. How do you know whether you've got somebody who really gets it, or somebody who's going to make a bonehead mistake like this? You know, it's
To be honest, a lot of it is about process.
Yeah.
So if you have a solid process in place where you have a proper testing suite and proper mechanisms and controls for dealing with things, when something like this happens, it's very, very easy to learn from it if you have a process. Mm-hmm. You simply add a new test.
Right.
We didn't think that we needed to test for this. Clearly we do. Therefore, for henceforth and forevermore, the automated test suite will test for this.
But then you're only as good as each of the mistakes you've made.
but even that's a good start.
I sort of feel like everyone should audit each other, you know? I mean, within your industry, you know, have a bunch of guys from your competitor come over and try to wreck what you're doing, and you wreck what they're doing, and everybody shake hands at the end and go back to work, you know?
Well, there's actually companies that do that professionally. It's called penetration testing, and you pay them to hack you. And they tell you how they did it, and then you work with them to implement controls to prevent the issues.
And you hope you get a good one of those.
It's very important to get a good penetration tester, actually.
Was it one of those penetration testers, the one that got hacked because the line manager, the manager they socially engineered had a password of password or something like that?
I'm not sure what that company did, but it wouldn't surprise me if they put themselves forward as pen testers. It's very common for security companies to be pen testers.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a black art finding a good pen tester. But anyway, the point here, reading through it, this shouldn't have happened, but, you know, bad things always happen, even to the best of companies. Sure. So what's important to me here is their response. So scrutinizing our controls means they have controls, and implementing additional safeguards means they have safeguards, and that they are aware that they now need to update their process. So they clearly have a process, they've discovered a shortcoming in that process, and they're going to implement changes to that process to stop this happening again. So they all tick my good checkbox. Good. What also tips my good checkbox is that they've proactively gone through the logs and contacted everyone whose account was accessed during that time. And they have activity logs of everything that changes on people's sites, so they can actually check whether or not there was, files were edited, files were changed, files were downloaded. So they can check all of that. And from their logs, it shows that in that time window, there were less than 100 accounts that were accessed with wrong credentials. Mm-hmm. So there's less than 100 total people. And of those 100, there were no files changed or removed. So no one lost data.
Wow.
So they were able to check all this through their logs. So
that's good.
Their processes they were compromised, but they weren't completely compromised. It wasn't a Sony-like compromise where it was all doom and there was no silver lining at all. You know, they have some defense in depth here, and they have some good procedures for dealing with problems. The fact that the fix was out in 5 minutes from the moment of detection is a very positive sign.
Yeah.
So it's slightly worrying and slightly reassuring all at the same time. So this is a very, very mixed security story.
I think if you expect perfection, then it's a depressing story. But if you're realistic and know stuff happens, like you said, that can be okay. You know, one of the problems with us meeting so infrequently lately is I never got a chance to ask you to explain to me. There's been stuff about Dropbox not actually being secure in the past month, but we never talked about it.
There was a design issue in how credentials get, I guess, deactivated, I think is possibly the better term for it. When you install Dropbox on a new machine, you enter a username and password. Mm-hmm. And that generates a token for that computer. And henceforth, you don't have to enter your password every time a file is synced. Your password is never saved on the computer. This secure token is used instead.
Okay.
The problem is that token, if you take that token from a computer and put it on a different computer, that token still works. The token isn't in any way cryptographically bound to a piece of hardware.
Okay.
And that's the problem. So if someone hacks into your machine and steals your Dropbox token, they can use that token to access your Dropbox account from their computer.
Oh, I got you. Because it's not tied to the hardware.
So what they should have done was, using what we talked about last week, to digitally sign So you take the token, mm-hmm. you take the serial number of the CPU, and then you use a digital signature to lock those together, and then you could have a token that only works on one computer.
Oh.
Now, Dropbox has said they're going to address the problem with the tokens, and in fact, I think they already have done in newer versions of Dropbox, in the 1.x versions of Dropbox.
So it's not an insecurity on the server side, it's on the client
no.
side.
It's a design thing. They didn't think when designing the token system that they should make sure that the tokens were bound to the hardware in some way. So it was too easy to take a token somewhere else. You could disable that token. If you log into Dropbox, it will show you all the tokens that are valid. And it also show you everything that everyone has done on your Dropbox account. So you can always detect that this is happening if you take the time to look. So if, say, you have three computers and you log into your Dropbox account on their webpage and it shows four computers being registered, then clearly one of those isn't you. And kill all the credentials. Just, you know, disable them all. And then each of your computers that's actually yours will ask you for your Dropbox login again because you've just nuked their key. And they'll generate a new key for themselves and then you should be fine. So it was worrying because the tokens didn't invalidate themselves. And it was a poor design. But it wasn't a hack or a compromise.
Okay.
And they said they're going to update their design.
Okay.
Well, it is serious in a sense because if, you know, you have a bit of Windows malware that goes around harvesting everyone's Dropbox tokens. But then again, if they're on your machine, they can read your Dropbox without having to take your token. So you can argue over and back about how serious it is. It's a silly design which needs to be improved. And from what I gather, they have said they will improve it. So, okay.
Hmm. Okay. So it's not doom and gloom. Well, we've probably gone a little long on security light, but I wanted to...
We have one more.
Oh, we've got one more? Okay.
An important one. This is the first one where we can actually do something about it. Apple have released 10.6.8 and security updates 2011-004 for 10.5. So both Tiger Leopard and Snow Leopard have important security updates. So you should run them.
Okay, good. Good. An interesting little tidbit here. I ran software update right before we started and it pretended mm-hmm. it was doing the update. But when it got done, it said, hey, there's security updates. Like after it made me reboot, so I get to do it again. But I noticed, oddly, in there was an update to Final Cut Pro X, which I thought was really interesting because it came from the store. But the update did not come from the Mac App Store. I double-checked that the Mac App Store did not see that it needed an update. Instead, they sent it through Software Update.
That is unusual, but iWork has always got its updates through Software Update.
Yeah. Oh, it has?
Yeah.
Even if you buy them through the Mac App Store?
I've never bought them through the Mac App Store, so I don't know if that changes things. It's an interesting one.
Yeah.
Maybe Apple's own software is going to keep coming through Apple's own software update app. Maybe in Lion, they'll all get unified into one interface.
Could be. Anyway, we haven't even gotten to our main topic yet. We've been almost 20 minutes. I should stop asking so many questions, but I'm just interested.
Well, there are two security questions that I think are going to catch people's attention in headlines. That's why I thought we should stick them in the show notes.
Absolutely.
So we promised last week we'd talk photography.
Yay!
And what I did was, we have this thing on our wiki called Topics for When Bart Gets Back, and I've just harvested another two out of that long list. And that'll do us for this week, and then we can keep going from there.
Sounds good.
So I agonized a little bit what to call this, and I decided good photographic etiquette is the best way to describe it. So if you think of a newspaper, one of the most important people is the editor, and it's his job to condense all the possible stories in the world down into a small set of well-written stories with all the superfluous fluff taken out. So he wants, you know, if there's bad paragraphs, he'll strip those out. If there's poor sentences, he'll strip those out. And what you should be left with is a collection of stories where each story is well put together.
It's too bad newspapers have gotten rid of those editors, obviously, lately, since there's typos in the Wall Street Journal now. But anyway, I get your point of what that person should have been doing.
Yeah, so the point is you have this sea of information and the editor culls it down to a sensible newspaper.
Right.
And within each story, the editor also culls things down to be a good story. So we always think of editing photographs and we almost always think of what you do in Aperture or Photoshop, which is the second thing. It's the fixing one of your stories thing, which is equivalent to taking out the typos.
Mm-hmm.
But the bigger job of actually putting together a whole that hangs together, we tend to leave out. And so if you want people to look at your photographs, you have to do that second type of editing or people will get very, very annoyed at looking at your photographs. If you go to someone's stream and they went to some event, let's say it was, you know, some fancy steam train visits some town in America somewhere, and you went there because you were interested, and you took 500 photographs. One of your jobs as a photographer is to narrow that down to a small set of photographs that tells the story. And if you upload all 500 and expect people to do that work for you, they will be annoyed.
Right.
It's not their job to look for the wheat among the chaff. It's your job as a photographer to do that filtering down, that selection. You don't have to throw all the other ones away, but when you're presenting your work, you present the subset of your work that tells the story. And if you don't do that, people are going to be annoyed at you. And they may cast a cursory glance and pose very nice just to mollify you, but they're unlikely to actually spend any time looking at your photos and unlikely to give you any useful critique. And if they do, you're unlikely to find it amidst the vast morass of all your own photos.
Yeah, I think there's actually an analog in video. I want to say it was Don McAllister did a video a couple of years ago of Macworld, and it was simply a set of snippets held together with some low-level music, and you could hear what was going on in the videos, but there'd be a little bit of a party, a little bit of the entranceway, a little bit, you know, showing some of the big logos hanging in the forum area, you know, a pan of a room, that kind of thing. And it told the story. It was very short, but it didn't give you, you know, the entire presentation of somebody.
Yes, exactly. Because people couldn't sit through a 20-hour video of every presentation at Macworld. It's not what they want.
Right. Unless that's what you put up and said, this is the 20-minute presentation of, you know, Steve Jobs giving his keynote or whatever.
Yeah. Usually when you're putting photographs on Flickr or Facebook or something, you know, there was some event or there was something that you're taking pictures of. And if you're, you know, most modern people in the modern age will, you know, let's say it's a wedding. You know, you have the cutting of the cake is a very important part of the story. You probably took 20 pictures of the cutting of the cake, out of which you should get 1, 2, maybe 3 good photos that really tell the story. You know, the knife going in,
the smashing of the woman,
Yeah, exactly. There's certain parts of it, and you've probably taken 10 or 20 pictures of each part, and you should spend the time looking at each one and saying, no, this is the better one that tells the story. And in fact, the better one that tells the story is the one that you should then spend your time tweaking an aperture to get it looking its best, and then you post that to Flickr or Facebook. And then you go on to the next part, maybe the speeches. Or the ring. And there's various parts to a wedding. So for each one, you have far too many photographs. Edit them down, and then you're going to be left with the story of the wedding in good photographs. And people are going to be very interested in those photographs. They're going to get the wedding in 20 or 30 photos.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I know going to look at your photographs, a lot of times it's just one, and you may have taken 150 photographs in that day, but it's the one that actually captures the thing you're trying to show.
Yeah. Or if you think to when you visited Ireland, I might have posted about 20 pictures from your time with us here.
I may have posted a few more than that, but... I went to 6 countries in 2 weeks.
I was just going to say, exactly, you're the visitor. That's somewhat different because, you know. But you need to do that work of editing down so that the people you share with don't have to do that work for you. You should also help the people that are viewing your photographs by really helping the photograph to tell its story. So you should give photographs titles. DSC_054 is not a valid title for a photograph. And putting _Ireland after it for all of your 500 pictures or whatever isn't a valid title either. Right? You're allowed to give a photograph a description. Pretty good idea. You know, what are we looking at? You know, it doesn't have to be an essay, but, you know, the happy couple cut the cake as everyone smiles and whatever. You put some sort of little description to say what's going on. You know, notice Uncle Joe in the background is falling asleep again. Ha, ha, ha. I mean, whatever. But, you know, what's going on in the photograph? Describe
right.
it.
Right.
A lot of places allow you to tag people in photographs. Flickr does, Facebook does. Assuming that they're people who are happy to be tagged, which they will have set on their preferences in whatever site you're using, you should tag them. You know?
Yeah, I like tagging is huge.
Yeah, it helps people to appreciate your photographs.
I think so.
If you're taking photographs of places, let's say you're going to the Grand Canyon or somewhere, or even something less well-known, some local attraction that's not nationally known but is very beautiful, geotag your photographs.
Hmm.
That way, people looking for photographs of that place will be able to find that photograph, and it will help someone.
Oh, really? You can search by geotag location?
In Flickr, if you go to the Explore area, you can type in any place in any country, and it will show you photographs people have taken there.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
It's wonderful. So if you're going on holiday somewhere, you're like, I wonder what Tralee on the south of Ireland looks like. Just type Tralee into the Explore, and you'll see all the photographs people have taken of the beautiful beachfront and the lovely pier, and etc.
So cool. Geotagging. I'm going to go look for pictures on Flickr.
So geotagging, if it's of places. Now, geotagging comes with certain caveats. If you're taking a picture of your grandmother's sitting room, she probably doesn't want that geotagged. If you're taking pictures of your sitting room, you probably don't want the geotagged.
Probably not so, so you know, much.
Yeah, you apply geotags sensibly, just like you tag people sensibly. If you know someone is trying to stay anonymous or someone doesn't want to be known, then you don't tag them in the photo because then you're just disrespecting their wishes.
Right,
and
right.
You know, you look after people's privacy. The other thing, I mean, a lot of people upload photographs to Flickr and they could be really high quality photographs and you'll see that they get almost no views and you feel very sorry for them because, you know, you took a nice photograph, you edited it well, you might even have given it a reasonable title, but you haven't given the description or you haven't added any keywords and no one's going to find that photograph. If you type into Google image search, whatever the place is or whatever the keyword is, if your photograph's been keyworded, it will be somewhere in that sea of results. Oh. If your photographs haven't been keyworded, it simply won't.
So it doesn't could be search amazing... the name? It doesn't? Why bother
Google
putting
Google will
that
search
name
a lot
there?
Of stuff. Well, the Google will search a lot of things. But within Flickr itself, it's often very nice. If you find a keyword, you can click on any keyword in anyone's photograph. Or when you hover over it, you get a button saying, all photos from this person with this keyword or all photos from anyone with this keyword.
Huh.
So it's a really great search aid.
And,
so
and it really only uses the keywords that are typed in as keywords. Not it doesn't search the description.
Well, a keyword search will only search keywords. Google will see descriptions and titles too. But keywords are sort of, if you can imagine, keywords are like shouting it out in a crowd. So Google will rate keywords higher than just random text.
And the rest is just noise, right?
Yeah. So keywording is a very good idea, and you see this a lot, where if someone goes somewhere and they take an amazing picture, say, of Arches National Park, and it's called DSC underscore whatever, and they don't give it a description, and they upload it to Flickr, and it will never be found. It could be a perfect sunset framed within one of the great arches or something like that. It could be an amazing photograph, but without the metadata, only their friends will see it, and maybe only once.
Ah, but what if you kept it DSC underscore blah, 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 and then but you put a really good keyword on it? Would it be viewed?
That would
then?
Help. That would help.
But do both.
But doing both is always better. And, okay. You know, the titles are there to make your photos human friendly. The keywords are there to make your photos search engine friendly.
Okay. Okay. I hadn't really thought about it that. I spend so much care putting good names on that I rarely actually tag photos because I'm thinking, geez, you can't read it. I mean, I'm just being redundant.
Well, it depends on what you're taking a picture of. You often take family shots. And you're putting them on Facebook, so their keywording is less important.
Right, but even when I do it on Flickr...
Let's say when you went to Sedona, and you took beautiful photographs of those wonderful red rocks, and you put those on Flickr, they would be worth the effort of keywording.
Okay, okay. Yeah, I do put when I've got a cool-looking photo that's not just interesting because, you know, Lindsay was in it or something. If I take a picture of something and I'm proud of how it looks, I always feel a lot of pressure on Flickr, like it's got to be good enough.
Sure, that's not a bad thing.
I think it's the circles I run in. I'm not sure everyone else lives with that much pressure, but I will put them up there, but it never occurred to me that the keywords were that important. I probably do it from time to time, but I'll have
They're very, very helpful for searching, both within Flickr and within the wider universe.
Okay.
And the final tip is that if it sounds like too much effort to do this on all of your photographs you upload to Flickr or Facebook, maybe you're uploading too many.
Hmm. Yeah.
So we sort of round it back to the first point. Less, but so that you can actually present them properly. So edit them down so that people have less work. And then those that you do choose, really put the work in so that it's a very rewarding experience for people to look at your photos.
I think you and I have talked about this before. We have friends and acquaintances who shall go unnamed who will upload, you know, 75 pictures of the same thing. And it's just like, really, you thought it was worth my time to figure out which was the good one, not your time?
Exactly.
You know, why did you do that?
That's it, exactly. And I'm certainly not going to mention names, but there's some up-and-coming photographers I follow on Flickr, and there are some gems in some of these streams. I think maybe about three people in particular, absolute wonderful, wonderful photographs. And they're swamped in a sea of 20 to 30 of almost the same and just not as good photographs. And if they were to take those gems and post only the gems and not the other stuff, they would have such an interesting stream that would attract massive attention. And as it is, you see these gems of photographs getting 3, 4, 5 views when they're worth thousands of views. And it's just because you have to put in the effort to separate the wheat from the chaff yourself. You do that, not your viewers.
So I'm thinking about my All Things D coverage, and I put 55 photos up from that session. If you take out my pictures of the pelicans, and I have an issue about pelicans, so
let's say they're cool to you. You should share them.
And I did take about 40 photos, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 in the stream. But excepting those, every photo is of a different person of a different part of the show. So yeah. I don't have two pictures of Walt Mossberg doing the same thing. He might be in more than one because he was, you know, obviously
he's
more interesting.
Interviewer, so.
Yeah, he's the main guy. But, you know, in general, there's like one picture of each thing where I took 20 of each thing.
Exactly. So, you know, you have the interview between Walt and the head of Verizon or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's, and you pick your best photo to show those two having the most, you know, animated discussion that you can, you know, out of right. your 20 photographs. And that's the one you share. And that tells the story perfectly. Okay. Making people search for that one good photo amidst the 19 others doesn't help.
Got you. Okay. I want to make sure I'm doing it right. But
that's it exactly. Because actually, your stream of D is a good example of telling the story. It's not full of meaningless clutter. You've chosen the best shots from the different talks and you put them up. And there's a nice flow through it. Okay, so it's Walt talking to this guy and then it's Walt talking to this guy. You're usually quite good about putting in descriptions about what it's of.
Right.
Which is important. So who is Walt?
I don't think I tagged any of these with D9, which I think
would have been a good idea to help your photographs be easier to find.
Sure,
because D9 is the kind of thing people could be searching on, and it would be good to have that keyword there.
Okay, all right. At some point, I'm going to ask you the best way to do that because typing a D9 55 times will get kind of old. But
you can actually use the bulk editor in Flickr to do a lot of these things. The bulk editor is really quite good.
Cool. We'll have to have you teach me that offline, though. That's probably out
sure.
of topic.
Oh, absolutely.
Here.
And in fact, you're better off doing it in the aperture stage where you can simply select all the photographs and drop the keyword on them all. And then Flickr will remember the keywords that you've
put
in an aperture. Yes, they pass through.
Oh, okay. All right.
So that's how I do. I do all my keywording in aperture and then Flickr just takes it.
Oh, okay.
And I do my geotagging in aperture. And then you have to actually click add to map, but it will already know where the photo is because it was already geotagged before. And you just click OK, make it public, and then it's public.
Oh, cool.
Okay, so the second thing is actually the same thing, only extended. So we've talked about presenting only your best work, and that's the most important thing. But you may also want to keep less. So presenting much less, everyone should do. And then opinion is divided as to whether you should keep everything, only presenting the best, or keep a lot, only presenting the best, or keep very little, only presenting the best. But everyone agrees that you should only present the best to the public.
Okay.
It's the what to do about keeping them is where opinion is somewhat divided. I'm of the opinion that although hard drive space is cheap, it's not free, and it's very difficult to manage a library of millions of photographs when you could be managing a library of hundreds of thousands.
True.
So I like to, as has become proverbially known, BART my photographs. And it's part of the same process, because really the process of editing your photos down and the process of choosing what to keep are very, very related things.
This might be a character attribute, though.
So oh, yes.
There's people who, and I count myself in the middle of the ground here, but I get emotionally attached to the photos I've taken.
Mm-hmm.
So I took 35 pictures of those darn pelicans, and I only showed you 8. And I was quite proud of myself, but I have most of those pelican photos still in my library. Now, what I have found is that emotional attachment goes away over time. So I can come back a year from now and go, oh, cripes, get rid of all the, you know, 3 and under starred pelican pictures because those are dopey.
Yes.
But right after
exactly.
I took them, I just, like, they're like my children. I mean, I can't delete them, you know? I delete the bad ones, but I don't delete the mediocre.
It's definitely easier to do over time than it is to do straight away. What I do is I star all of my photographs, and if they make it to 4 or 5 stars out of 5, then they're considered flickerable. Mm-hmm. And I won't necessarily flicker them all, because I may have 2 4-star photographs of the same thing where I will choose and say, yeah, they're both flickerable, but I'm only going to flicker this one because they're very similar photographs. Mm-hmm. But if it's not 4 or 5 stars, it's very, 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 very unlikely to end up on Flickr, unless it's one of those once-in-a-lifetime things and you didn't actually get a great shot, but it's never, ever, ever going to happen again. So you're going to share it even if you know it's only a 2 or a 3-star.
Right.
So I tend to say 4 and 5 stars are flickerable. 3 stars are kept, but not really considered for Flickr. And anything less than that is binned, unless it's part of, say, the input to an HDR or the input to tone mapping or the input to some process, in which case I'll group them together and collapse the group so I only see the top one and I don't see the lesser photos that constitute the final product. Because okay. I think you should keep that in case you want to reprocess.
That's actually a really good idea to group them like that, because they call in Aperture, at least what he's talking about is they actually collapse under it, so you get looks like a stack of files, a stack of photos on top of each other. Right, right.
That's actually what they call an interface, is stacking. So I stack them together if these multiple photographs build up the final product, and I put the final product as a stack pick and then collapse the stack. So all you see as you're scrolling through is the end product. And if in the future you say, I really want to re-edit that, I'm not happy with X, Y, or Z, or I've got better software, or I've learned better skills, mm-hmm. you just uncollapse it, and then you have your raw materials there. You do the work again, and then...
That's a good idea. One of the things I get stuck on is I'll take 5 photos and combine them into a panorama. And I don't really want to get rid of those photos, but I usually do because it looks stupid in my library. It's like, well, that's a picture of nothing, because it isn't interesting until it's part of the panorama.
Of course,
but if I stacked it, I'm going to do that. That's a really good suggestion.
That's a perfect, perfect example. So you have a 5-part panorama. Each 5 photograph is probably going to be a 1 or a 2-star, because really it's nothing.
Right.
But the combined product is easily a 4 or a 5-star. So stack them and collapse them, and then all you see is the 5-star on top, and you safely keep the others.
Because I do like to go back and go, okay, now I got better panorama software. Let me try it on this one and see what happens.
I regularly go back and re-edit my old HDRs, because I was really quite poor at it at the start. You know, I've learned a lot, and I've gotten better tools. So it's well worth going back to some of your better shots and reprocessing them.
Right, right.
It's not worth going back to a shot that was poor out of camera. You know, if it wasn't in focus... Mm-hmm. It's not going to get in focus.
Right.
You know, that's just gone. So I'm very ruthless on a technical level. If I'm scanning through my photos and I see anything that's not sharp, it just gets binned. I used to keep them because, oh, I really wanted that to be good. Well, it's not going to become good. Yes, I wanted it to be good.
I know exactly what you're talking about. And you keep going back to it, going, did it get better while I was looking away from it?
And it doesn't. It just gets worse. So I've taught myself to bin those straight away, and that takes a bit of training. But once that's done, then you're left with the more sort of subjective choices. And what I think you should do is you should use the sort of the digital attic type features. If you think about it in the real world, some of us are hoarders. I would be in that category.
You would be?
What I do in the real world, oh yeah.
Oh.
What I do in the real world is whenever the stuff I know I really should throw out but I can't bring myself to throw out, it goes up in the attic. Mm-hmm. If it's still there in 5 years and I haven't gone looking for it once... It goes in the trash.
Okay.
Because I've had a 5-year buffer where I could develop a need for it by some bizarre mechanism. And if I haven't needed it in 5 years, I do not need it. It is, in fact, junk, and it should be thrown out. So there's a digital equivalent, which is called rejecting your photograph. And Aperture does this, Lightroom does this, and I'm sure many other things do too. If you mark a photograph as rejected, it vanishes from the normal interface and only becomes visible when you ask the interface to show me my rejected shots.
Oh, so they're not gone. What that was for. I was thinking if I reject it, why wouldn't I just delete it?
It's for if you're not really sure. So you can reject it and it's consequenceless. You haven't lost the photo. If you come back and you look at it, oh my God, I had 20 pelican shots. I've kept none. I was obviously overdoing my editing. I should go back and at least find one to keep. They're there. They're rejected. They're not deleted.
Okay.
So using the reject option means that you can put stuff away and you say, I don't think I'm ever going to need this again, but it's out of sight, out of mind. And then the next time you're low on hard drive space, you have one final scan through your rejecteds to make sure that there really isn't something in there you shouldn't have put there, and then you delete it. Okay. And then you get your hard drive space back and you know that they're not photographs that were particularly important. A lesser technique for that is simply to use the trash can. You know, delete the trash once a month, say. And then say, okay, I haven't needed them in a month. They're probably fine. Delete them. But the rejecteds are a nice mechanism if your software supports it.
That is one thing that I didn't know. I think you told me maybe 2 years after I started using Aperture that there was a trash can. Somehow it just never occurred to me. And I had, 95,000 photos in there. And I have 938 files in the trash right now.
Yeah, they're probably fine for deleting.
Yeah, oh, they are. If I put them in the trash, I meant to delete them, but I forget that there's a trash can in there.
Well,
it even shows
you're low
me
on
what
space.
Folders they were in and everything. So
and you can restore them back very easily. Yeah. So the trash in Aperture actually got a serious upgrade in Aperture 3. It's become much better than it used to be. Because in Aperture 2, it didn't actually have a trash in Aperture. It put them into your system trash, and then they were much harder to restore.
Right, but I thought that's where they were. I thought that's where they were, so I didn't realize I wasn't emptying the trash, and so I had.
I think that was in iPhoto, because in Aperture they were in your real trash until Aperture 3, okay. But in iPhoto you had a separate bin. And I think it's in iPhoto you discovered that your iPhoto bin was full of stuff, because you had assumed it was in the system bin, but it never was.
Okay.
So now they're consistent between the two apps, which is good, because it makes it easier for people to go from iPhoto to Aperture, the more similar they are. And it's just more sensible.
That does. That's lovely.
So you have the rejecteds is one mechanism. And the trash is another mechanism to help you to get around to deleting stuff. And it makes your life much easier if you can edit stuff down.
You know, the whole idea of going back after 5 years if you haven't gone to it, I know many, many more than one peoples at work who will move and then not get around to opening two boxes, say, for 5 years, and then they go to move, and they're starting to move that thing. And I'm like, really, you can't just throw that away now. There should be no mystery to you whether you need that or not. You haven't opened it.
exactly. Now, the one thing, of course, is I have a separate place where I put keepsakes that I know I'm going to want to keep, so they don't get mixed up in that cycle.
Ah, good.
You know, invitations to weddings and christenings and that kind of thing, they need to be kept somewhere actually safe. But, you know, my old notes from quantum mechanics class. I kept them for a couple of years after I graduated. I looked at them again and realized I couldn't even read my own handwriting. If I need to learn this stuff again, I'll get a book.
Right, I'm sure there's an audiobook or something or a podcast about it.
Exactly, or I'll read the Wikipedia entry. So, and they just got thrown out. Stacks and stacks of really bad handwriting. I was like, I really don't need this.
We did actually get rid of that in our house, but it was only recently that we got rid of our college textbooks. And I was
all replaced.
Yeah. What are you going to do with them? But to me, I kept some at work because they tell people I'm an engineer because I have to keep shouting that to make them remember.
Well, do you have Saraway in your office?
Saraway?
It's a giant book, Physics for Scientists and Engineers. It's
No. We were Halliday and Resnick. And
that was my undergraduate physics textbook in experimental physics, and in mathematics physics it was Physics for Scientists and Engineers.
There you go. Well, I kept that one. I kept Halliday and Resnick, and we named our cats after those two authors.
Yeah, so I basically have almost none of my textbooks from university left, but I still have Physics for Scientists and Engineers. A, you could kill someone with it. It's about 4,000 pages in a hardback.
Or if you need to glue something down, you know, you need to hold it down while it does it to the weight. You'll be glad to know that before we binned all of them, Kyle just happened to catch me before I threw them away and said, hey, do you guys by any chance have a copy of Feynman's Lectures on Physics? And we had two copies of it, but we'd gotten rid of one of them, and he was so happy that we had a copy for him. So,
well, that's good. I wouldn't have thrown in Feynman.
Yeah, there's some things you got to keep.
Yeah, but the math book went, and you know, I threw most of mine out. Anyway, so you know, do think about the same in photography, and to me, it's all part of the one editing stuff down.
And I like your title to this whole section, calling it etiquette, because it does putting up bad photos, too many photos, you know, not naming them. That's all annoying to someone else, right? That's why it fits into the etiquette stage.
I think it's impolite. Honestly, I think it's impolite to send someone a link to a dump of garbage and expect them to thank you for it. To me, it's impolite, and maybe I'm a little too strong on that, and maybe I'll get me in trouble, but I consider it rude. So I do think it is a case of etiquette.
I think it does fit that, though, Bart. I don't think you're out of line saying it. So if you go back to the 30, 40 years ago, the days of home movies, or where someone would sit you down with their photo album and force you to sit there and look at it. At least in this case, you can just skip on past if you think they're idiotic, but you're still kind of irritated, right?
Yeah, it's like the same person's head blocking the Sphinx, the same person's head blocking the pyramids, the same person's head blocking something else. Oh, I hated that. A bunch of different views of the same person's head blocking this and that and the other. It was horrible.
Invariably, they were holding the photo album and choosing when to turn the page, and you couldn't just go flick, 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 flick.
Exactly. And you're you know, it's the digital equivalent of that is to send people a link to this massive thing, and digitally they won't actually look at them, and you can't stand over their shoulder and make them look. And they'll probably write a little comment at the end of their album saying, "Oh, thanks very much, they were lovely, ha ha ha." What they're actually doing is fubbing you off.
All right. Well, on that note, I think I better call this episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond. I really, I'm glad we spent the extra time on the security stuff because, like I said, we haven't had enough of that for a long time here. So I appreciated your insight. And as always, now people know what we mean when we talk about barting our photos.
Well, hopefully.
All right, Bart, we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Until 2 weeks from now. Until then, happy computing.
All right. Well, isn't it fun to have Bart back? I know we've said that 100 times. I'll get over it pretty soon, but it's still just great joy to me. And the chat room was going crazy and loving having him back. So it's a lot of fun. And it was funny for me to realize that about 2/3 of the people who are listening right now weren't here when Bart went out. So it's kind of a big treat for them to get to meet Bart for the first time. I'm really excited to have Steve Stanger on the show for Chit Chat Across the Pond next week. He's going to walk us through how to get prepared for Lion. He's careful and methodical, but he's not like a little old lady scared of stuff, so he's a great person to ask for advice on this. I need the advice because, you know me, I'll just fling it on there in my production machine, and the live chat room will have to suffer through me screaming and everything, so I think it's going to be great getting his advice. But that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills. We've got Screen Steps and Smile with us. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions, and specifically let us know on the NoSilicast, the Twitter feed and the new Facebook feed to let us know what kind of things you want us to do there. In the meantime, you can email me at allison@podfeet.com and follow me on Twitter at Podfeet or NoSilicast. And NoSilicast, follow them both. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.